Verge Jury would hear from Stephen Hayne, and only Stephen Hayne. Though he had no prior history of abusing or molesting children, by the time Havard's trial began 10 months later, word had spread around Adams County that he was a pedophile and baby killer. Studies have shown that not only can eyewitness memory change over time, it can be significantly altered with the acquisition of new information. That appears to be what happened in Havard's case, as some witnesses' memories grew considerably more vivid by the time of his trial. Jurors heard the sheriff, the coroner, and the medical staff at the ER describe tears, rips, lacerations, and other injuries to the child's anus. Some claimed to have seen blood. Two nurses said it was the worst example of anal trauma they had ever witnessed. Yet once the infant had been cleaned off, Hayne's own autopsy photos showed there were no rips, tears, lacerations, or similar injuries anywhere on the girl's rectum, only the dilation and small contusion. Despite his own photos, and the fact that he made no mention of sexual abuse in his autopsy notes, Hayne played up the contusion at trial. He told the jury that it was an inch long, not a centimeter, as he put in his report. While he conceded that he had found no tears or lacerations, he speculated that rigor mortis, the tightening of muscles after death, could have caused the girl's rectum to close, hiding any tears or cuts from his view. But if that was the case, Hayne should have accounted for it in his autopsy and looked more closely for tears. He did neither. Hayne also testified that because he found the symptoms of shaken baby syndrome, he could conclude that Chloe had been violently shaken to death. To emphasize the point, Hayne and the prosecutors exchanged the phrase violently shaken an additional 6 times. Havard's defense attorney wasn't exactly aggressive. The prosecution called 16 witnesses, whose testimonies comprised 261 pages of the trial transcript. Havard's attorney called a single witness, a nurse at the ER. His testimony takes up 3 pages. The state didn't even bother to cross-examine. It's hardly surprising, then, that the jury convicted Havard and sentenced him to die. The entire trial, deliberation, guilty verdict, sentencing trial, deliberation, and death sentence took 2 days. After Havard was sentenced, his case was taken up by the Mississippi Office of Capital Post-Conviction Counsel, which had been set up by the state Supreme Court to guarantee that indigent defendants in death penalty cases received adequate legal representation. That office had funding to hire its own experts. Havard's new attorneys asked former Alabama State Medical Examiner James Lauridsen to review Hayne's autopsy and trial testimony. Lauridsen found a number of problems. Most notably, he found no evidence of sexual abuse at all. But for Havard's direct appeal, Lauridsen's opinions didn't matter. In a 2006 ruling, the Mississippi Supreme Court delivered a brutal 1-2 punch. The court first upheld the trial judge's decision to deny Havard funds to hire his own forensic pathologist, finding that Havard's trial attorneys had failed to show why an independent medical examiner was necessary. The justices then explained that because Lauridsen's affidavit wasn't submitted during Havard's trial, they were barred from considering it on appeal. The court upheld his conviction and death sentence. The ruling was unanimous. Havard's first post-conviction appeal came 2 years later. In post-conviction, a defendant has more leeway to introduce new evidence, but the bar for a new trial is set much higher. This time, the court had to at least consider Lauridsen's affidavit. It did, but not all that carefully. For example, in his report, Lauridsen referred to medical literature documenting the fact that the anus often dilates in infants shortly after death, and that this is often mistaken for sexual abuse. He disputed Hayne's contention about rigor mortis and speculated that the ER staff likely mistook the exposed lining of the girl's rectum for blood. Like others before him, Lauridsen also had difficulty getting the tissue slides from Hayne, but when he finally did, he found nothing on them that suggested sexual abuse. The majority opinion roundly dismissed Lauridsen's report, and also appears to have badly misread it. Justice George Carlson wrote that Lauridsen opined in his affidavit that there is a possibility that Chloe Madison Britt was not sexually assaulted. Carlson then wrote, "Taking this statement to its logical conclusion, this leaves open the possibility that she was." That isn't necessarily the logical conclusion at all. Worse, the phrase, "there is a possibility," which Carlson put in quotes, doesn't actually appear anywhere in Lauridsen's affidavit. Lauridsen actually wrote, "The conclusions that Chloe Britt suffered sexual abuse are not supported by objective evidence and are wrong." Lauridsen did write that he couldn't definitively say there were no signs of sexual abuse, because that would require examination of Haines' tissue slides, and at the time of his original report, he still didn't have access to them. When he finally saw them, Lauridsen was much more conclusive. Justice Carlson continued to mischaracterize Lauridsen's report throughout his opinion. It was arguably a more forceful brief for the state than those submitted by the prosecutors themselves. Havard's appeal was denied, and his conviction and sentence upheld. The vote this time was 8-1. The lone dissent was from a justice named Oliver Diaz, though Diaz didn't write an opinion. That dissent would come back to haunt him. In March 2012, the Mississippi Supreme Court again denied Havard relief. His attorneys had asked for a new trial because in the intervening years, even Stephen Hayne had changed his opinion. Sort of. In a declaration for Havard's attorneys, Hayne wrote, "Based upon the autopsy evidence available regarding the death of Chloe Britt, I cannot include or exclude to a reasonable degree of medical certainty that she was sexually assaulted." Hayne also acknowledged, as Lauridsen had pointed out, that a dilated anus is not in itself evidence of sexual abuse. Even here, Hayne was typically hard to pin down. He managed to reframe his trial testimony without directly contradicting it. At trial, Hayne had never definitively testified that Chloe Britt had been sexually assaulted. He merely said her injuries were consistent with that possibility, then speculated that one possible method of assault could have been penetration of the rectum by an object. The prosecutor did most of the heavy lifting to advance the assault narrative, often by citing the observations of the ER staff, sheriff, and coroner. For most of his testimony, Hayne merely acquiesced, despite the fact that he knew he'd found no biological material from Havard on or in the child, and that the only anal trauma was the small contusion. Forensic experts say a credible and conscientious medical examiner should have said at trial what Hayne stated in his declaration a decade later. A credible medical examiner wouldn't have let the jury be misled and wouldn't have allowed a prosecutor to use his own testimony to do so, even if his own testimony wasn't technically false. 3 months later, the Mississippi Supreme Court rejected Havard once more. Justice Carlson again wrote the opinion. Carlson first argued that Hayne's declaration and deposition in 2012 weren't substantially different from his testimony at the trial. Hayne hadn't explicitly testified at trial that Chloe had been sexually abused, Carlson argued, so his 2012 declaration stating he had found no evidence of abuse wasn't really new evidence. Yet in his 2008 opinion, Carlson himself wrote that Jim Lauridsen's conclusion that the girl's dilated anus was not indicative of sexual abuse was contrary to that of Dr. Hayne and that of emergency room personnel. Hayne may not have explicitly testified that the dilation was caused by sexual assault, but his testimony was so suggestive of it that even Carlson at the time seemed to think that this was Hayne's position. The jury obviously did too. In two rulings, handed down just 4 years apart then, Justice Carlson had found that Hayne's testimony supported the jury's findings of sexual assault, and that Hayne had never explicitly testified that a sexual assault had taken place. Hayne could make a state Supreme Court justice argue two self-contradictory points without realizing that they were contradictory. It's little wonder why prosecutors loved him. Carlson closed his opinion with one last and especially absurd contradiction. Carlson first claimed that Haines' 2012 declaration wasn't new evidence because it was duplicative of the Lauridsen affidavit that the court had rejected in 2008. Yet, as noted, in that 2008 decision, Carlson himself wrote that Lauridsen's opinion was contrary to that of Dr. Hain. Between his 2008 and 2012 opinions, then, Carlson asserted that A. Lauridsen's affidavit contradicted Hain's trial testimony, B. Hain's 2012 declaration was duplicative of that affidavit, and yet C. there was no substantial difference between Hain's trial testimony and his 2012 declaration. Logically, these three things can't possibly all be true. Two affidavits can't at the same time be both duplicative of and contrary to one another. And yet Carlson stated exactly that. So did his fellow justices. Again, the court denied Havard's petition. This time, the vote was unanimous. Over the next few years, the state's case against Havard continued to deteriorate. First, two more forensic pathologists reviewed the case and wrote scathing reports deriding Hain's work. Then, in January 2014, Hain appeared to walk back his trial testimony even more. In an interview with the Clarion Ledger, Hain said he never believed Chloe Britt had been sexually assaulted at all. The following July, he filed another affidavit with Havard's trial attorneys, this time claiming he had explicitly told prosecutors on more than one occasion that he could not support a finding that Chloe had been sexually assaulted. Havard's attorneys said this information was never turned over to them. At Havard's trial, the prosecutor told jurors that Hain would testify for you about his findings and about how he confirmed the nurses and doctors' worst fears: this child had been abused and the child had been penetrated. Now, all this time later, Hain claimed he explicitly told prosecutors precisely the opposite. If true, that would be a major violation on the part of state prosecutors. Hain's statement to them would have been exculpatory information, and they would have been obligated to turn it over. Moreover, Hain was the only medical examiner to testify, and the alleged sexual assault was not only a major part of the state's case, but the aggravating factor that allowed prosecutors to seek the death penalty. While it now seems clear that Chloe really wasn't sexually assaulted, Hain's latest attempt to rehabilitate his role in the case is hard to comprehend. Although it's true that he never explicitly testified that Chloe Britt had been sexually abused, his testimony did plenty to help prosecutors convince the jury she had. A medical examiner has an ethical duty to clarify whatever point is being made, whether by the prosecution or the defense, says Jamie Downs, a medical examiner who has served on numerous forensics ethics committees and recently edited the book Ethics in Forensic Science. If someone is putting words in your mouth or manipulating your testimony to give a false impression, you have an obligation to speak up and say that's incorrect. If Hain knew all along that State had persuaded a jury to convict Jeff Havard of an assault he never believed happened, why did he wait 13 years before speaking up? Why did he speak up only after three other forensic pathologists filed affidavits? In 2015, Jeffrey Havard finally caught a break. It was a modest win, but it at least put his execution on hold. In April of that year, the Mississippi Supreme Court gave Havard's attorneys permission to request an evidentiary hearing on the scientific validity of SBS. The court still rejected Havard's claims challenging the allegations of sexual abuse. The ruling wasn't an exoneration, and it wasn't a new trial. It was a three-paragraph order giving Havard permission to ask a trial court judge to hold a hearing to determine the scientific validity of SBS. In June 2016, the judge granted permission for the hearing. If Havard could convince the judge that shaken baby syndrome is no longer a scientifically reliable diagnosis, he'd finally get a new trial. It took Havard's jury less than 2 days to deliberate, convict him based on bad scientific evidence, hear evidence on appropriate punishment, deliberate again, and sentence him to death. It took 13 years for the courts to admit that a small portion of the bad evidence might have been scientifically unsound. It took another 14 months for the trial court judge to agree to hold a hearing on the matter. It will be another 14 months from that decision until the hearing itself. It's often said that the wheels of justice grind slowly. That isn't always true. When it comes to convicting people, they can move pretty swiftly. It's when the system needs to correct an injustice, admit its mistakes, that the gears tend to sputter to a halt. For now, Havard remains on death row. The Havard case is also illustrative of the way Mississippi state officials have neglected their duty to look into Hain. Beginning in the late 2000s, media exposés and groups like the Innocence Project had finally begun to single Hain out for criticism. For the most part, Mississippi prosecutors and coroners continued to defend him. One of the more important of those officials has been Mississippi Attorney General Jim Hood, who himself used Hain back when Hood was a local district attorney. By 2013, Jeff Havard's case had attracted a lot of attention. The Clarion Ledger and the Huffington Post had both published articles about Havard, and a website and Facebook page maintained by his friends and family has been marshaling supporters. The fact that Hain was now arguably contradicting his own testimony in a death penalty case made it hard for officials like Hood to continue to defend him. By that time, Havard's case was in federal court. He had exhausted his state appeals. So in August 2013, Hood's office filed a motion in federal court asking for a gag order. Hood wanted to prohibit the public from seeing any further filings or proceedings. The state claimed the motion was sparked by a Facebook post from one of Havard's lawyers who had complained that the state didn't want to be bothered by actually responding to his, Havard's, claims of innocence. But the state's brief itself revealed the real motivation. Havard's case had become a public spectacle. The Attorney General's office argued that it had received letters from Havard supporters and expressed concern that the letters were similarly worded, which suggested the letters' authors had all gotten their information from the same source. Why this was of such grave concern isn't exactly clear. A federal judge ruled against the motion. Hain's testimony in yet another shaken baby syndrome case was more controversial still, and provides an even more egregious example of the length to which state officials have gone to defend him. Christopher Brandon was convicted in 2009, well after the concerns about over-diagnosing shaken baby syndrome had been documented in both medical literature and the popular press. But Hain also cited a textbook that actually states the precise opposite of what he claimed at trial, and cited a study that doesn't appear to exist. Brandon claimed that his girlfriend's 15-month-old son died after falling and hitting his head on a toy. There was an external bruise on his head. Hain claimed the infant had been violently shaken, despite the absence of any signs of neck trauma. As in other cases, the trial judge had refused to give Brandon funding to hire his own pathologist to review Hain's work. Brandon's attorney asked Hain if he was aware that some researchers had begun to question the basis for the SBS diagnosis. Hain said he was, but countered by first citing a forensic pathology textbook written by Vincent DeMaio. "There are disagreements in the field," Hain answered, "but the standard text, DeMaio and DeMaio, they list shaken baby syndrome as a cause of death, and they go into the explanation of the different variables that constitute shaken baby syndrome. So the preponderance of the experts in this country do believe an injury like this to be shaken baby." Hain was then asked about a recent study showing that the injuries commonly attributed to SBS can occur in a short-distance fall. He replied, "That would be in disagreement with the vast preponderance of the literature." The attorney followed up, "But had he read the study?" Hain replied, "Yes, counselor, that has been roundly argued against that position by that particular physician. I think the most important article that has come out recently is the ALPERI study by Harvard University in the Mass General, and they disavow that position. With no one to counter Haines' testimony for the defense, Brandon was convicted. After his conviction, another medical examiner reviewed Haines' work and concluded that the child did not die from being shaken and that his medical condition had been affected by an advanced case of pneumonia. Even when defendants were given funding to hire their own experts, Haines' testimony often won the day. But as with Jeffrey Havard, the Brandon case shows how, when there was no one to counter him, Haines could be absolutely devastating. A defense expert well-versed in the SBS literature, for example, might have pointed out that the DeMaio textbook Haines cited on the witness stand actually states the precise opposite of what Haines claimed. From the textbook, "The authors of Forensic Pathology have grave reservations as to the existence of SBS. This was expressed in the first edition of this book. Since then, we have no reason to change this opinion, but rather to solidify it. There is just no conclusive evidence that this entity exists." If that isn't clear enough, DeMaio himself also said in a 2014 interview that Haines had misappropriated his text. When asked if it was possible Haines' testimony could have been mistaken but well-intentioned, DeMaio replied, "No, I don't think it's possible. Look, that passage about SBS begins with a quote from Alice in Wonderland. You would think that would be a good indication that we are skeptical of the diagnosis. I don't know how he could have honestly misread it." Then there's Haines' mention of the ALPERI study by Harvard University in the Mass General. That study doesn't appear to exist. A search through databases dedicated to SBS scholarship, as well as the entirety of the Westlaw and LexisNexis databases of literature dedicated to SBS, reveals that no such study exists, Brandon's lawyers from the Mississippi Innocence Project wrote in a post-conviction petition. Furthermore, counsel have consulted with both legal and medical experts in the field of SBS who have never heard of the study or anything like it. They added, "In short, the circumstances suggest that Dr. Haines simply conjured up a scholarly journal article." Both these examples from Haines' testimony would likely have been exposed had Brandon been permitted to have his own expert in the courtroom. Even a defense attorney well-versed in SBS cases isn't likely to have a thorough enough grasp of the literature to recognize a non-existent study or to know when a textbook has been misquoted. But an expert in the field likely would. Without an expert, Haines was able to give bad information to the jury without rebuttal. In his closing argument, the prosecutor doubled down on the misinformation by misleading the jury about why Haines' testimony went unrebutted. Referring to Brandon's claim that the infant died from a fall, the prosecutor told the jury that every doctor in the world says it, Brandon's story, is impossible. It's impossible. Incredibly, he then argued that Brandon's defense team didn't call an expert witness to contradict Haines because no such experts existed. Brandon's story was not impossible. There are plenty of doctors who would say so, and there were plenty at the time. The defense didn't call any of them to the stand not because they didn't exist, but, again, because the court didn't provide Brandon with the funds to hire one of them. The state's reaction to Haines' testimony was even worse. In July 2014, the Office of Attorney General Jim Hood filed a response to Brandon's motion for a new trial that's almost too absurd to believe. After first conceding that they too could not find the mysterious study that Haines had mentioned at trial, the state did point out that in 2012, the Alpert Medical School of Brown University hosted a conference on shaken baby syndrome that included a panel discussion about short-distance falls. Because the name of the school sounded vaguely similar to the name Haines mentioned as the author of his mystery study, it is more likely that Dr. Haines was recalling these studies than it is that he entirely fabricated a study, the state wrote. That sounds like a plausible explanation, until you consider that Hain attended Alpert Medical School at Brown. It seems unlikely that he'd mistake the name of his own medical school for the author of a study. But there's also a much more profound problem with the state's attempt to rehabilitate Hain's testimony. The Boston Conference was held in 2012. Christopher Brandon's trial took place in 2009. By the laws of physics, Hain couldn't possibly have recalled a presentation from a 2012 conference during testimony he gave in 2009. The state also added that the same medical school hosted a similar conference in 2010 and posited that perhaps that was what Hain was recalling. We're at least getting closer, but we're still faced with the fact Hain couldn't possibly have recalled a 2010 conference during testimony he gave in 2009. For years, Mississippi state officials have argued that Hain could competently perform 1,800 or more autopsies per year, all while testifying in court, completing his continuing education, and holding down two full-time positions. In the Brandon case, they either were alarmingly careless about fact-checking their arguments, or suggesting that Stephen Hain could slip the bounds of time. It's odder still that instead of merely asking Hain to submit an affidavit clarifying his testimony, the state resorted to such wild speculation about what he actually meant. In August 2014, the Mississippi Supreme Court ruled in Brandon's favor on every claim and ordered the Lee County Circuit Court to hold an evidentiary hearing. That same year, the Mississippi Supreme Court overturned another conviction that was due in part to Hain's SBS testimony. The court in that case didn't explicitly criticize Hain, but ruled that the trial judge was wrong to deny the defendant funding to hire his own expert. Mississippi elects its judges at all levels, from local justice courts to the Supreme Court. Over the years, the campaign and election process has produced a lot of scandals and even a few indictments. But one noticeable effect has been to weed the state's highest court of justices with an inclination to protect civil liberties and the rights of the accused. And that has produced a court that, for the most part, remained reliably unskeptical of Hain and West. The two factions that have poured the most money into judicial elections in recent years are the plaintiff's bar, more commonly called trial lawyers, and pro-business groups like the Chamber of Commerce. The judicial candidates who rise out of the plaintiff's bar tend to be more friendly to regulation and civil liability for corporations accused of wrongdoing, but in a state as conservative as Mississippi, Democrats tend to compensate for those positions with aggressive law and order policies on issues like policing, the death penalty, and due process rights. Mississippi's two most recent attorneys general, current AG Jim Hood and his predecessor Mike Moore, are good examples. Both have been heavily supported by the plaintiff's bar, but both are also adamantly pro-death penalty. This sort of political splintering benefited Hain and West. Many of the state's criminal defense attorneys are also trial lawyers. They get paid a few thousand dollars per month to be the official public defender for some county or town, but make the vast majority of their living as plaintiff's attorneys. Civil liability cases in areas like medical malpractice or product liability often involve allegations of a wrongful death. Those cases require an autopsy. For someone like current Mississippi Attorney General Jim Hood, Hain was the only game in town. He also served a dual purpose. He helped many of Hood's supporters win wrongful death cases, and he helped prosecutors like Hood win convictions. The few justices on the court who have shown proclivity to, say, protect the constitutional rights of criminal defendants or to criticize the application of the death penalty in capital cases have come under heavy scrutiny when they run for re-election. That's how James Robertson, perhaps the closest thing the state has ever had to a civil libertarian justice, was defeated in 1992. It's complicated, says the longtime Mississippi defense attorney Andre DeGree. I've spent my entire career here, so I've only known a system in which judges are elected. but my sense is that whether you appoint them or elect doesn't make much difference at the local level. But at the appellate level, you probably get better judges if they're appointed. John Holdridge, the defense attorney who was an early critic of Michael West, says his bigger worry is how the fear of losing a bid for re-election can bias an incumbent. My sense is that elected judges find it very difficult to rule on these issues when it's going to seriously affect the prosecution in a high-profile case. I think that's why James Robertson may have voted with the state in the Tracy Hansen case when he otherwise may not have, says Degree. There were protests outside the Supreme Court at the time. You don't want to be known as the justice who turned a killer loose. Hansen was convicted of killing a Mississippi state trooper in 1987. There wasn't much doubt about his guilt, but there were some problems with his trial, and he was sentenced to death under the vague death penalty jury instructions later struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. The Mississippi Supreme Court voted unanimously to uphold both the conviction and the sentence, and Robertson wrote the opinion. Hansen was executed in 2002, ending Mississippi's 13-year dry spell. Robertson lost his election anyway. A 2013 report by the liberal group the Center for American Progress found that spending on the 2000 Mississippi Supreme Court elections surged by over $3 million. In fact, a single group called the Law Enforcement Alliance of America, LEAA, spent more on Mississippi Supreme Court races than all of the candidate campaigns combined. There's some evidence that all of that spending has affected how the court rules. In its next term, the court ruled against criminal defendants in 90% of the cases it heard, a 20% increase over the previous term. Perhaps that was due more to the facts of the cases the court considered in those terms, but the report found a similar correlation in other states where Supreme Court justices are elected. As spending from outside groups went up, so did the frequency with which the courts ruled against criminal defendants. In the early 2000s, Mississippi was ground zero for all of these interests. By the early 2000s, trial lawyers, pro-business groups, and law and order groups were all spending furiously to seat their preferred justices in Jackson. For the most part, the trial lawyers backed one candidate, while the pro-business and law and order groups backed the other. There really weren't any well-funded interest groups to promote civil liberties or protections for the accused. But it didn't always line up that way. In the 2000 Supreme Court elections, Justice Lenore Prather, who had become the state Supreme Court's first female justice in 1982 and its first female chief justice in 1998, was heavily favored to win re-election and had strong backing from the Chamber of Commerce. Toward the end of the campaign, Prather's opponent, a little-known municipal judge named Chuck Easley, began attacking her for being soft on crime. Prather was a moderate conservative. She had occasionally voted to overturn convictions, but rarely went out on a limb. She voted to uphold Kennedy Brewer's conviction and death sentence in 1998, and then to deny him DNA testing in 2000. Easley won, in an upset that surprised much of the state. The Mississippi justice everyone expected to lose in the 2000 campaign was Oliver Diaz, an affable, mop-haired former state legislator from the Gulf Coast. Diaz made his jump to the judiciary in 1994 when he was elected to the Mississippi Court of Appeals. In March 2000, Governor Ronnie Musgrave appointed him to the state Supreme Court to finish the term of a justice who had recently died. But the term to which Diaz was appointed expired later the same year. He'd barely had time to zip up his robe before he had to start thinking about re-election. The Chamber of Commerce spent $800,000 trying to defeat Diaz, including TV ads accusing him of supporting baby killers and drug dealers when he sat on the Court of Appeals. Somehow, Diaz still won. But in winning, he had to raise a lot of money in a short amount of time. That would eventually present problems for him. Diaz later affirmed that the ads affected how his fellow justices handled criminal cases and that it was causing opinions based more on politics than the law. A fellow member of the Mississippi Supreme Court actually saw those ads, and after that point, he refused to vote to overturn criminal cases, Diaz told Think Progress. Judges who are running for re-election do keep in mind what the next 30-second ad is going to look like. By the end of his first and only complete term, Diaz would emerge as the court's toughest critic of Stephen Hain. He'd also have some personal experience with the criminal justice system that would make him better equipped than his colleagues to talk about the perils of letting the political process run roughshod over the judiciary. But his outspokenness would eventually get him voted off the court. The next justice to feel the wrath of law and order groups was Charles Chuck McRae. By the end of the 1990s, McRae was really the only justice willing to take a skeptical look at Michael West. To that point, he was the only judge in the state who had actually criticized West in an opinion. No judge, McRae included, had so much as batted an eye at Stephen Hain. McRae seemed more like the protagonist in a Hemingway novel than a state Supreme Court justice. He was more brash than bookish, more insouciant than stuffy. In 2003, Forbes described him as a colorful, cocky figure who drives a motorcycle to the courthouse and dresses in cowboy boots, blue jeans, and lots of leather. The same year, the Franklin County Times noted that McRae had run with the bulls in Pamplona, climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, and enjoyed scuba diving in the Bahamas. The Clarion Ledger noted that he sometimes swam in public while wearing only a thong. McRae grew up poor and orphaned on the Gulf Coast, but moved to Pennsylvania just before graduating high school. He returned to Mississippi after college to teach and coach high school, then went to law school. Despite his criticism of West, McRae was hardly a bleeding heart on criminal justice. While he was a former president of the Mississippi Trial Lawyers Association, he had also served as counsel for the Pascagoula Police Association. But McRae was an outspoken opponent of tort reform, and by the time he was up for re-election in 2003, it was a hot issue, nationally and especially in Mississippi. That put him squarely in the crosshairs of pro-business groups like the Chamber of Commerce. McRae didn't do himself any favors. In 1995, he had crashed his sports car just outside of Jackson and then refused to take a breathalyzer. He was sentenced to a 2-hour meeting with victims of drunk drivers, which sparked, probably accurate, accusations of special treatment. In 1999, his behavior on the roads again put him in the headlines when he and a friend were pursued by a Mississippi Highway Patrol officer while riding their motorcycles. The friend stopped. McRae didn't. He sped up, taking the officer on a chase through Jackson, during which McRae at times exceeded 100 miles per hour. Despite all of that, one of the more damaging blows to McRae's re-election hopes was over what, in retrospect, was perhaps his finest moment on the court. During the 2003 campaign, the LEAA bought a round of TV ads touting McRae's opponent, Jess Dickinson, whom the ads called a strong leader who supports the death penalty. The ad then ominously shifted to McRae. When a 3-year-old was sexually assaulted, the Mississippi Supreme Court upheld the murderous conviction. Only Judge Chuck McRae voted to reverse it. A similar ad delivered the same ominous message. McRae was the only judge to reverse the conviction of the murderer of a 3-year-old girl. The murderer to which both ads referred was LaVon Brooks. McRae lost his re-election bid by 30 points. No one really thrives or flourishes in prison. But LaVon Brooks did better than most. His charisma and optimism served him well. So did the fact that at 30, he was a little older and perhaps wiser than most of the men in his cell block. "It felt like a dream," Brooks says, reflecting back to the first days after his sentencing. "I remember I questioned God. What have I done to deserve this?" Brooks at first thought he'd have to harden. Everyone I knew who had been in prison came out so doggone mean, he says. I figured it would turn me too. But he quickly changed his outlook. My mama told me, you do what you gotta do in there, but don't change who you are. God's gonna get you out. Brooks pauses after he says this, then lets out a soft laugh. She was right. It sure took him a while, but I got out. And I didn't get one write-up for disciplinary problems while I was in there. I'm proud of that. Brooks's experience cooking at the Santa Barbara helped him get a spot in the prison kitchen. That was critical. It made him feel productive, gave him something to do. More importantly, it gave him access to food, which he could occasionally distribute outside the rules. It would become powerful currency for him, first to carve out some independence and space for himself, and then to help out his fellow inmates. You'd be surprised what you can get done with extra sandwiches, he says. Brooks also helped guards and other prison staff with their paperwork. Having always had some talent with a pencil, he began drawing greeting cards and selling them to prison staff. That earned him both some spending money and additional favor. He then put that favor to use in the kitchen, where he'd sneak in indulgences like fast food for his fellow inmates. Sometimes he even got unofficial permission to prepare fancier meals on holidays. Ever the opportunist, he also used his kitchen access to sell sandwiches to guards and other prison personnel on the side. Brooks says his dominion over the kitchen provided him with some protection. Despite the conventional wisdom about what happens in prison to people convicted for hurting or sexually abusing children, Brooks says he was largely left alone and was able to avoid the prison's gangs. Over time, his lack of affiliation positioned him to become something of a broker between the gangs and between the gangs and the guards. He says he once helped a man get out of a prison gang, get into protective custody, and eventually get transferred to another prison. He stopped another man from hanging himself. You just have to keep your humanity about you, Brooks says. That's how I got by. You do little things for people, you make their lives better, and it comes back to you. He kept his eye out for new inmates in particular. It's lonely when you first get in, he says. It goes a long way if you think you have an ally, that there's somebody on your side. It can be the smallest thing. Brooks would typically reach out to new inmates with the only thing he had the power to do. He'd give them an extra half sandwich or an extra piece of meat. I just tried to look out for folks, he says. One story in particular still moves him. A few weeks before Brooks was released from prison, a white man came to visit him. The two had been in the same cell block, but Brooks never really got to know the man. I do remember when he first got in, though, Brooks says. He was a bad case. He was hurting. He just had this broken look about him that said, "What am I going to do?" The man was released several years later. Soon after he got out, he came back just to see Brooks. "So he came back to visit me," Brooks says. He had tears in his eyes. Said he just wanted to come back and thank me. I didn't know what he was talking about. I asked him, what did I do? And he said, you gave me extra food. I never forgot that. Brooks gets choked up himself as he tells the story, so he stops and collects himself. No matter what color you are, we all serve one God, he says. Like I said, you just have to humble yourself. You just have to keep your humanity. In 2000, well after Michael West had been widely criticized in both the media and the forensic world, Don Lampton, a longtime district attorney in central Mississippi, sought West's help in his prosecution of Lee Stubbs. The story begins in March 2000, just after Stubbs had successfully completed rehab at a drug addiction center in Columbus, Mississippi. She checked out of the facility with Tammy Vance, a friend she met in rehab, and Kim Williams, the woman Stubbs and Vance would later be accused of assaulting. The three women first drove to the home of Dickie Irvin, whom Williams had been dating. Vance and Stubbs left and later met back up with Williams, who by then had stolen some of Irvin's OxyContin. Vance and Williams began drinking and taking the OxyContin, while Stubbs stayed sober and drove them around. The three eventually ended up at a comfort inn in the town of Brookhaven. By evening, Vance and Williams had passed out. Stubbs checked the three of them into the hotel. According to the hotel clerk's trial testimony, Stubbs didn't seem drunk, high, or otherwise intoxicated, only tired. She would pass a drug test the next day. By Stubbs's account, she then helped the other two women into the room, and the three went to sleep. The next day, Stubbs and Vance went to get some food, leaving Williams in the room still sleeping. Later that afternoon, Stubbs and Vance noticed that Williams still hadn't woken up and was having trouble breathing. They called an ambulance. Williams had suffered a drug overdose and had fallen into a coma. At the hospital, doctors found a number of injuries on Williams, including swollen breasts, a swollen and bruised vagina, and some marks across her buttocks. The attending physician estimated the injuries to be 2 to 4 days old. A rape kit was inconclusive. Another doctor later found an additional injury to Williams's head. The police opened an investigation. A few days later, Lampton called in Michael West to examine Williams's injuries. Williams, who ultimately recovered, was never able to remember the event. West initially didn't find any bites on Williams. It was only 5 days later that he claimed to have found a mark on her hip. During that exam, West also claimed to have found injuries to Williams's vagina that he described to be consistent with sucking. He deduced that these injuries had been inflicted during severe oral sex. West then compared the alleged bite mark on Williams's hip to dental mold that had been taken from Stubbs, Vance, and two other suspects. That took a few days. By the time the plaster impressions arrived, Williams's alleged wounds had faded. So West performed his analysis based on photographs he had taken of his findings several days earlier. He would later testify that he had determined it was a probability that the bite mark he claimed to have found on Williams's hip had been inflicted by Stubbs. In a rare display of humility, West did concede that he wasn't 100% certain of the match, only that it was likely. Stubbs and Vance were arrested and charged with assaulting Williams. At trial, West showed the jury a photo of the alleged injury to Williams's hip and told them, "I must admit, to a novice, this may not appear to be a bite mark by any means." But he assured them it was in fact a human bite mark. But West didn't stop with bite mark analysis. He had a lot more to say. On the night of the alleged attack, the Comfort Inn had a security camera trained on the parking lot. Lampton had obtained a VHS tape with grainy footage from that night and sent it to the FBI for analysis. The agency found nothing incriminating in the footage. In fact, the FBI report repeatedly pointed out that the quality of the recording was too low to even say for certain how many people are depicted in the video, much less determine their identities or what sort of clothing they're wearing. Unsatisfied, prosecutors sent the video to Michael West. The Copernicus of forensics then morphed into a video enhancement expert and claimed that by using off-the-shelf Adobe software he'd bought for his computer, he was able to enhance the video and capture still photos from those enhancements that implicated Lee Stubbs and Tammy Vance in Williams's injuries. Though obligated by law to do so, state prosecutors never turned over the FBI report or the correspondence with West to Stubbs's defense attorney. The ability to enhance security camera footage beyond its original resolution is a fictional Hollywood trope so common that mocking it has become a running internet meme. Yet where the FBI determined that the video was too grainy to even make out how many people were in the frame, West confidently told the jury there were two. He claimed he could also tell that one of the people was wearing shorts and the other blue jeans, two details that matched neatly with police reports of what Stubbs and Vance had worn that night. Where the FBI could only determine that someone had removed an object, possibly a bag or suitcase, from a toolbox in the truck bed, West claimed he could make out hair, legs, and another pair of jeans, leading him to conclude that the object was obviously a body. "She takes a body out of this toolbox," West conclusively told the jury. "That's what I see." He didn't stop there. West also claimed he could actually read the body language of one figure in the footage. He said he could tell that the figure appeared anxious and was exhibiting the sort of adrenaline-fueled fight-or-flight response one shows after having committed a crime. The video showed none of these things. It was grainy, flickery, and dark. At best, a viewer might make out a truck, and perhaps the vague form of a few other cars. It's possible to make out human figures walking out to and back from the truck, but they have all the detail of an 8-bit video game, only in black and white, and with the brightness turned to low. West apparently knew that the jury wouldn't be able to see any of this, so he conditioned them to unquestionably accept his expertise. "What I see isn't what everybody else sees," he said. "There are interpretations." As for the bite mark, West again used his direct comparison method, and, just as in the Kennedy Brewer and Jimmy Duncan cases, forensic specialists who have reviewed the case say West likely created it himself. A video of his examination surfaced years later on the blog of forensic experts and bite mark analysis critics Michael Bowers and David Averill. The video depicts West repeatedly jamming the mold of Stubbs's teeth into Williams's thigh, just as he'd done in other cases. The alleged bite mark doesn't appear until after West does so. In this case, West's subject was alive but comatose. On the blog, Bowers, a longtime West critic, writes, "West then proceeds to tamper with the evidence by actually embedding a stone cast of Lee Stubbs's teeth into the comatose victim's hip, resulting in a fabricated bite mark on the skin of the victim." In a 2011 interview, Bowers offered this opinion. "The tampering with the evidence on the skin is likely a crime, but to create those marks on a woman who was comatose and who hadn't given consent is also an assault," he said. Still not finished, West then donned his tool mark expert cap and claimed to have found marks on Williams's head and thigh that matched the shape of the latches on the toolbox in the truck bed. He added, "Those two latches are 37 inches apart, and if you look at Kimberly Williams, from the head injuries to the thigh injury is 37 inches. West elided the fact that the distance between Williams's head and thigh would vary a great deal depending on how she was positioned. Even if she had been put into the toolbox, there's no way West could have known her positioning, much less have replicated it to the inch, while she lay unconscious in a hospital bed. Police investigators also found no biological material from Williams in the tool chest. No blood, no hair, no skin cells. West explained that biological material can be wiped away with a good scrub and some chlorine. But there was a problem there, too. Investigators did find some hair, but it didn't belong to Williams. For his final act, West transformed himself into a behavioral psychologist, or perhaps just a bigot. After hinting that Stubbs may have been a lesbian, Lampton asked if one might be especially likely to find bite marks in an assault perpetrated by a homosexual. West, who was no more credentialed to be giving jurors an expert opinion on how lesbians quarrel than he was on severe oral sex, replied that it wouldn't be unusual. Lampton pushed further, asking West if bite marks after an altercation between homosexuals would almost be expected. "Yes," West replied, "almost." Years later in a deposition, West would refer to the Stubbs trial as the case of the two lesbians that bit the girl's vagina lip off. Once again, the jury bought it. In 2001, Lee Stubbs and Tammy Vance were both convicted of assaulting Williams and for stealing OxyContin and methadone. The only evidence against Stubbs for stealing drugs was that she happened to be with Williams and Vance when the drugs were taken. Stubbs, who had no prior criminal record, was sentenced to 44 years in prison. In 2003, the Mississippi Supreme Court upheld both the convictions and West's testimony. The ruling was unanimous. The court had already stated that it had accepted bite mark evidence as scientific and credible in the LaVon Brooks case. As to the various other areas of forensics in which West testified, the court found that either Stubbs' trial attorney failed to properly object or that they were satisfied that Stubbs had the opportunity to both cross-examine West and to call her own expert witness to challenge him. The court added, "This does not mean that Dr. West can indiscriminately offer so-called expert testimony in other areas in which he not even remotely meets the criteria. We caution prosecutors and defense attorneys, as well as our learned trial judges, to take care that Dr. West's testimony as an expert is confined to the area of his expertise." Given the wide-ranging fields in which West testified in the case, it's hard to imagine what the court could possibly find outside of his expertise. By the time the Mississippi Innocence Project took up the case in 2008, even Mississippi prosecutors were no longer using West. Yet while Mississippi Attorney General Jim Hood has admitted that West isn't a credible witness, Hood and his staff have nevertheless continued to fight to preserve convictions won on West's testimony. Typically, these cases are in post-conviction, which usually means that the defendant at some point has already argued that West should not have been permitted to testify, and almost certainly lost that argument. Instead of arguing for West's credibility, the state now argues in these cases that the defendants are procedurally prohibited from re-raising West's testimony as an issue. Legally, they're on shaky ground. There has been a sea change surrounding forensic evidence nationally, and bite mark matching has come under particular fire. But morally, it's reprehensible. If he wanted, Hood could drop the charges in all of these cases, or at least agree to a new trial without testimony from Hain or West. Instead, his office argues about procedure. That's exactly what Hood's office argued to keep Lee Stubbs and Tammy Vance in prison. And they were succeeding until Stubbs's father tracked down the FBI report on the surveillance video that Lampton never turned over to the defense, along with the correspondence between West and Lampton that referenced the report. He then handed the report over to Stubbs's new lawyers. That finally did the trick. In June 2012, a district court judge threw out the convictions of both Stubbs and Vance, citing the state's failure to turn over exculpatory evidence. The following year, Hood's office backed down and offered the women a plea bargain. If they pleaded guilty to the drug charges, the state would dismiss the assault charges, agree to a sentence of time served, and let the women eventually expunge all the charges from their records. The women agreed. Don Lampton used West and his preposterous testimony well after West's exploits were well known. In an ideal world, that should have ended his career as a prosecutor. Instead, in 2001, President George W. Bush nominated Lampton to be U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Mississippi. Lampton died in 2011. Christopher Plourd was furious about what happened to his client, Ray Crone, and rightly so. Crone had twice been wrongly convicted of murder and was nearly executed. Thanks to bite mark testimony from a local dentist and renowned bite mark analyst Raymond Rawson, Crone was convicted of murdering a cocktail waitress in 1992 and again in 1996. Over the strenuous objections of prosecutors, Plourd eventually persuaded a court to allow DNA testing on biological evidence from the crime scene. In 2002, the testing showed that Crone was innocent. It provided a match to a man named Kenneth Phillips, who should have been a suspect from the start. After 10 years in prison, including two on death row, Crone was exonerated and released from prison. Plourde, offended and angry that his client could have been convicted not once but twice, based on quackery that had been presented in court as science, decided to conduct his own blind proficiency test